desperate among them all, that I can't leave. No, not even to be saved from the life I'm leading now.
Your having interfered in this dear boy's behalf before, said Rose, your coming here at so great a risk to tell me what you have heard, your manner which convinces me of the truth of what you say, your evident contrition and sense of shame, all lead me to believe that you might be yet reclaimed. Oh, said the earnest girl, folding her hands as the tears coursed down her face, do not turn a deaf ear to the entreaties of one of your own sex, the first, I do believe, who ever appealed to you in the voice of pity and compassion. Do hear my words, and let me save you yet for better things.
Lady, cried the girl, sinking on her knees, dear, sweet angel lady, you are the first to ever bless me with such words as these, and if I had heard them years ago, they might have turned me from a life of sin and sorrow. But it is too late. It is too late. It is never too late, said Rose, for penitence and atonement. It is, cried the girl, writhing in the agony of her mind. I cannot leave him now. I could not be his death.
Why should you be? Asked Rose.
Nothing could save him, cried the girl. If I told others what I have told you and led to their being taken, he would be sure to die. He is the boldest and has been so cruel.
Is it possible, cried Rose, that for such a man as this you can resign every future hope and the certainty of immediate rescue? It is madness.
I don't know what it is, answered the girl. I only know that it is so, and not with me alone, but with hundreds of others as bad and wretched as myself. I must go back. Whether it is God's wrath for the wrong I have done, I do not know, but I am drawn back to him through every suffering and ill usage, and I should be, I believe, if I knew that I was to die by his hand at last.
What am I to do? Said Rose. I should not let you depart from me thus.
You should, lady, and I know you will, rejoined the girl, rising. You will not stop my going because I have trusted in your goodness and forced no promise from you, as I might have done.
Of what use, then, is the communication you have made? Said Rose. This mystery must be investigated, or how will its disclosure to me benefit Oliver, whom you are anxious to serve?
You must have some kind gentleman about you that will hear it as a secret and advise you what to do, rejoined the girl.
But where can I find you again when it is necessary? Asked Rose. I do not seek to know where these dreadful people live, but where will you be walking or passing at any settled period from this time? Will you promise me that you will have my secret strictly kept and come alone or with the only other person that knows it, and that I shall not be watched or followed? Asked the girl.
I promise you solemnly, answered Rose.
Every Sunday night, from 11 until the clock strikes 12, said the girl without hesitation, I will walk on London Bridge if I am alive.
Stay another moment, interposed Rose, as the girl moved hurriedly towards the door. Think once again on your own condition and the opportunity you have of escaping from it. You have a claim on me, not only as the voluntary bearer of this intelligence, but as a woman lost almost beyond redemption. Will you return to this gang of robbers and to this man when a word can save you? What fascination is it that can take you back and make you cling to wickedness and misery? Oh, is there no chord in your heart that I can touch? Is there nothing left to which I can appeal against this terrible infatuation?
When ladies as young and good and beautiful as you are, replied the girl steadily,
give away your hearts. Love will carry you all lengths, even such as you who have home, friends, other admirers, everything to fill them. When such as I, who have no certain roof but the coffin lid, and no friend in sickness or death but the hospital nurse, set our rotten hearts on any man, and let him fill the place that has been a blank through all our wretched lives, who can hope to cure us? Pity us, lady. Pity us for having only one feeling of the woman left, and for having that turned by a heavy judgment from a comfort and a pride into a new means of violence and suffering.
You will, said Rose, after a pause, take some money from me, which may enable you to live without dishonesty, at all events until we meet again.
Not a penny, replied the girl, waving her hand. "Do not close your heart against all my efforts to help you," said Rose, stepping gently forward. "I wish to serve you indeed."
"You would serve me best, lady," replied the girl, wringing her hands, "if you could take my life at once, for I have felt more grief to think of what I am tonight than I ever did before, and it would be something not to die in the hell in which I have lived. God bless you, sweet lady, and send as much happiness on your head as I have brought shame on mine."
Thus speaking and sobbing aloud, the unhappy creature turned away, while Rose Maylie, overpowered by this extraordinary interview, which had more the semblance of a rapid dream than an actual occurrence, sank into a chair and endeavoured to collect her wandering thoughts. End of side 10. Side 11. Chapter 41. Containing fresh discoveries and showing that surprises, like misfortunes, seldom come alone. Her situation was indeed one of no common trial and difficulty. While she felt the most eager and burning desire to penetrate the mystery in which Oliver's history was enveloped, she could not but hold sacred the confidence which the miserable woman with whom she had just conversed had reposed in her as a young and guileless girl. Her words and manner had touched Rose Maylie's heart, and mingled with her love for her young charge, and scarcely less intense in its truth and fervour, was her fond wish to win the outcast back to repentance and hope. They purposed remaining in London only 3 days, prior to departing for some weeks to a distant part of the coast. It was now midnight of the first day. What course of action could she determine upon, which could be adopted in 8 and 40 hours? Or how could she postpone the journey without exciting suspicion? Mr. Losburne was with them, and would be for the next 2 days, but Rose was too well acquainted with the excellent gentleman's impetuosity, and foresaw too clearly the wrath with which, in the first explosion of his indignation, he would regard the instrument of Oliver's recapture, to trust him with the secret, when her representations in the girl's behalf could be seconded by no experienced person. These were all reasons for the greatest caution and most circumspect behaviour in communicating it to Mrs. Maylie, whose first impulse would infallibly be to hold a conference with the worthy doctor on the subject. As to resorting to any legal adviser, even if she had known how to do so, it was scarcely to be thought of for the same reasons. Once the thought occurred to her of seeking assistance from Harry, but this awakened the recollection of their last parting, and it seemed unworthy of her to call him back, when, the tears rose to her eyes as she pursued this train of reflection, he might have by this time learnt to forget her, and to be happier away. Disturbed by these different reflections, inclining now to one course and then to another, and again recoiling from all, as each successive consideration presented itself to her mind, Rose passed a sleepless and anxious night. After more communing with herself next day, she arrived at the desperate conclusion of consulting Harry. "If it be painful to him," she thought, "to come back here, how painful it will be to me! But perhaps he will not come. He may write, or he may come himself, and studiously abstain from meeting me. He did when he went away. I hardly thought he would, but it was better for us both." And here Rose dropped the pen and turned away, as though the very paper which was to be her messenger should not see her weep. She had taken up the same pen and laid it down again 50 times, and had considered and reconsidered the first line of her letter without writing the first word, when Oliver, who had been walking in the streets with Mr. Giles for a bodyguard, entered the room in such breathless haste and violent agitation as seemed to betoken some new cause of alarm. "What makes you look so flurried?" asked Rose, advancing to meet him.
"I hardly know how. I feel as if I should be choked," replied the boy. "Oh, dear, to think that I should see him at last, and you should be able to know that I have told you all the truth."
"I never thought you had told us anything but the truth," said Rose, soothing him. "But what is this? Of whom do you speak?"
"I have seen the gentleman," replied Oliver,
scarcely able to articulate.
"The gentleman who is so good to me, Mr. Brownlow, that we have so often talked about."
"Where?" asked Rose.
"Getting out of a coach," replied Oliver, shedding tears of delight, "and going into a house. I didn't speak to him. I couldn't speak to him, for he didn't see me, and I trembled so that I was not able to go up to him. But Giles asked for me whether he lived there, and they said he did. 'Look here,' said Oliver, opening a scrap of paper. 'Here it is. Here's where he lives. I'm going there directly. Oh, dear me, what shall I do when I come to see him and hear him speak again?'"
With her attention not a little distracted by these and a great many other incoherent exclamations of joy, Rose read the address, which was Craven Street in the Strand. She very soon determined upon turning the discovery to account. "Quick," she said, "tell them to fetch a hackney coach and be ready to go with me. I will take you there directly without a minute's loss of time. I will only tell my aunt that we are going out for an hour, and be ready as soon as you are." Oliver needed no prompting to dispatch, and in little more than 5 minutes they were on their way to Craven Street. When they arrived there, Rose left Oliver in the coach, under pretense of preparing the old gentleman to receive him, and sending up her card by the servant, requested to see Mr. Brownlow on very pressing business. The servant soon returned to beg that she would walk upstairs, and following him into an upper room, Miss Maylie was presented to an elderly gentleman of benevolent appearance in a bottle-green coat, at no great distance from whom was seated another old gentleman in nankeen breeches and gaiters, who did not look particularly benevolent, and who was sitting with his hands clasped on the top of a thick stick and his chin propped thereupon. "Dear me," said the gentleman in the bottle-green coat, hastily rising with great politeness, "I beg your pardon, young lady. I imagined it was some importunate person who... I beg you will excuse me. Be seated, pray." "Mr. Brownlow, I believe, sir," said Rose, glancing from the other gentleman to the one who had spoken. "That is my name," said the old gentleman. "This is my friend, Mr. Grimwig. Grimwig, will you leave us for a few minutes?"
"I believe," interposed Miss Maylie, "that at this period of our interview I need not give that gentleman the trouble of going away. If I am correctly informed, he is cognizant of the business on which I wish to speak to you." Mr. Brownlow inclined his head. Mr. Grimwig, who had made one very stiff bow and risen from his chair, made another very stiff bow and dropped into it again. "I shall surprise you very much, I have no doubt," said Rose, naturally embarrassed. "But you once showed great benevolence and goodness to a very dear young friend of mine, and I am sure you will take an interest in hearing of him again."
"Indeed," said Mr. Brownlow. "May I ask his name?"
"Oliver Twist, you knew him as," replied Rose. The words no sooner escaped her lips than Mr. Grimwig, who had been affecting to dip into a large book that lay on the table, upset it with a great crash, and falling back in his chair, discharged from his features every expression but one of unmitigated wonder, and indulged in a prolonged and vacant stare. Then, as if ashamed of having betrayed so much emotion, he jerked himself, as it were, by a convulsion into his former attitude, and looking out straight before him, emitted a long, deep whistle, which seemed at last not to be discharged on empty air, but to die away in the innermost recesses of his stomach. Mr. Brownlow was no less surprised, although his astonishment was not expressed in the same eccentric manner. He drew his chair nearer to Miss Maylie's, and said,
"Do me the favour, my dear young lady, to leave entirely out of the question that goodness and benevolence of which you speak, and of which nobody else knows anything, and if you have it in your power to produce any evidence which will alter the unfavourable opinion I was once induced to entertain of that poor child, in heaven's name put me in possession of it." "A bad one! I'll eat my head if he is not a bad one," growled Mr. Grimwig, speaking by some ventriloquial power without moving a muscle of his face.
"He is a child of a noble nature and a warm heart," said Rose, colouring, "and that power which has thought fit to try him beyond his years has planted in his breast affections and feelings which would do honour to many who have numbered his days 6 times over.
"I'm only 61, said Mr. Grimwig, with the same rigid face, "and as the devil's in it, if this Oliver is not 12 years old at least, I don't see the application of that remark."
"Do not heed, my friend, Miss Maylie," said Mr. Brownlow. "He does not mean what he says."
"Yes, he does," growled Mr. Grimwig.
"No, he does not," said Mr. Brownlow, obviously rising in wrath as he spoke.
"He'll eat his head if he doesn't," growled Mr. Grimwig.
"He would deserve to have it knocked off if he does," said Mr. Brownlow, and he'd uncommonly like to see any man offer to do it, responded Mr. Grimwig, knocking his stick upon the floor. Having gone thus far, the two old gentlemen severally took snuff, and afterwards shook hands, according to their invariable custom. "Now, Miss Maylie," said Mr. Brownlow, "to return to the subject in which your humanity is so much interested, will you let me know what intelligence you have of this poor child, allowing me to premise that I exhausted every means in my power of discovering him, and that since I have been absent from this country, my first impression that he had imposed upon me, and had been persuaded by his former associates to rob me, has been considerably shaken?" Rose, who had had time to collect her thoughts, at once related in a few natural words all that had befallen Oliver since he left Mr. Brownlow's house, reserving Nance's information for that gentleman's private ear, and concluding with the assurance that his only sorrow for some months past had been the not being able to meet with his former benefactor and friend. "Thank God," said the old gentleman. "This is great happiness to me, great happiness. But you have not told me where he is now, Miss Maylie. You must pardon my finding fault with you, but why not have brought him?"
"He is waiting in a coach at the door," replied Rose.
"At this door?" cried the old gentleman, with which he hurried out of the room, down the stairs, up the coach steps, and into the coach without another word.
When the room door closed behind him, Mr. Grimwig lifted up his head, and, converting one of the hind legs of his chair into a pivot, described three distinct circles, with the assistance of his stick and the table, sitting in it all the time. After performing this evolution, he rose and limped as fast as he could up and down the room at least a dozen times, and then, stopping suddenly before Rose, kissed her without the slightest preface.
"Hush," he said, as the young lady rose in some alarm at this unusual proceeding. "Don't be afraid. I'm old enough to be your grandfather. You're a sweet girl. I like you. Here they are."
In fact, as he threw himself at one dexterous dive into his former seat, Mr. Brownlow returned accompanied by Oliver, whom Mr. Grimwig received very graciously. And if the gratification of that moment had been the only reward for all her anxiety and care in Oliver's behalf, Rose Maylie would have been well repaid.
"There is somebody else who should not be forgotten, by the by," said Mr. Brownlow, ringing the bell. "Send Mrs. Bedwin here, if you please."
The old housekeeper answered the summons with all dispatch, and dropping a curtsy at the door, waited for orders.
"Why, you get blinder every day, Bedwin," said Mr. Brownlow, rather testily.
"Well, that I do, sir," replied the old lady. "People's eyes at my time of life don't improve with age, sir."
"I could have told you that," rejoined Mr. Brownlow. "But put on your glasses and see if you can't find out what you were wanted for, will you?"
The old lady began to rummage in her pocket for her spectacles. But Oliver's patience was not proof against this new trial, and yielding to his first impulse, he sprang into her arms.
"God be good to me," cried the old lady, embracing him. "It is my innocent boy, my dear old nurse," cried Oliver. "He would come back. I knew he would," said the old lady, holding him in her arms. "How well he looks, and how like a gentleman's son he is dressed again. Where have you been this long, long while? Ah, the same sweet face, but not so pale. The same soft eye, but not so sad. I have never forgotten them, or his quiet smile, but have seen them every day side by side with those of my own dear children, dead and gone since I was a lightsome young creature."
Running on thus, and now holding Oliver from her to mark how he had grown, now clasping him to her and passing her fingers fondly through his hair, the good soul laughed and wept upon his neck by turns. Leaving her and Oliver to compare notes at leisure, Mr. Brownlow led the way into another room, and there heard from Rose a full narration of her interview with Nancy, which occasioned him no little surprise and perplexity. Rose also explained her reasons for not confiding in her friend Mr. Losburn in the first instance. The old gentleman considered that she had acted prudently, and readily undertook to hold solemn conference with the worthy doctor himself. To afford him an early opportunity for the execution of this design, it was arranged that he should call at the hotel at 8 o'clock that evening, and that in the meantime Mrs. Maylie should be cautiously informed of all that had occurred. These preliminaries adjusted, Rose and Oliver returned home. Rose had by no means overrated the measure of the good doctor's wrath. Nancy's history was no sooner unfolded to him than he poured forth a shower of mingled threats and execrations, threatened to make her the first victim of the combined ingenuity of Messrs. Blathers and Duff, and actually put on his hat preparatory to sallying forth to obtain the assistance of those worthies. And doubtless he would, in this first outbreak, have carried the intention into effect without a moment's consideration of the consequences if he had not been restrained, in part by corresponding violence on the side of Mr. Brownlow, who was himself of an irascible temperament, and partly by such arguments and representations as seemed best calculated to dissuade him from his hot-brained purpose. "Then what the devil is to be done?" said the impetuous doctor, when they had rejoined the two ladies. "Are we to pass a vote of thanks to all these vagabonds, male and female, and beg them to accept £100 or so apiece as a trifling mark of our esteem, and some slight acknowledgment of their kindness to Oliver?" "Not exactly that," rejoined Mr. Brownlow, laughing. "But we must proceed gently and with great care." "Gentleness and care!" exclaimed the doctor. "I'd send them one and all to—" "Never mind where," interposed Mr. Brownlow. "But reflect whether sending them anywhere is likely to attain the object we have in view." "What object?" asked the doctor. "Simply the discovery of Oliver's parentage, and regaining for him the inheritance of which, if this story be true, he has been fraudulently deprived." "Ah," said Mr. Losbern, cooling himself with his pocket handkerchief, "I almost forgot that. You see," pursued Mr. Brownlow, "placing this poor girl entirely out of the question, and supposing it were possible to bring these scoundrels to justice without compromising her safety, what good should we bring about?" "Hanging a few of them, at least, in all probability," suggested the doctor, "and transporting the rest." "Very good," replied Mr. Brownlow, smiling. "But no doubt they will bring that about for themselves in the fullness of time. And if we step in to forestall them, it seems to me that we shall be performing a very quixotic act in direct opposition to our own interest, or at least to Oliver's, which is the same thing." "How?" inquired the doctor. "Thus, it is quite clear that we shall have extreme difficulty in getting to the bottom of this mystery unless we can bring this man Monks upon his knees. That can only be done by stratagem, and by catching him when he is not surrounded by these people. For suppose he were apprehended, we have no proof against him. He is not even, so far as we know, or as the facts appear to us, concerned with the gang in any of their robberies. If he were not discharged, it is very unlikely that he should receive any further punishment than being committed to prison as a rogue and vagabond. And, of course, ever afterwards, his mouth would be so obstinately closed that he might as well, for our purposes, be deaf, dumb, blind, and an idiot. Then," said the doctor impetuously, "I put it to you again, whether you think it reasonable that this promise to the girl should be considered binding, a promise made with the best and kindest intentions, but really—" "Do not discuss the point, my dear young lady, pray," said Mr. Brownlow, interrupting Rose as she was about to speak. "The promise shall be kept. I don't think it will in the slightest degree interfere with our proceedings. But before we can resolve upon any precise course of action, it will be necessary to see the girl, to ascertain from her whether she will point out this Monks, on the understanding that he is to be dealt with by us, and not by the law, or, if she will not or cannot do that, to procure from her such an account of his haunts and description of his person as will enable us to identify him. She cannot be seen until next Sunday night. This is Tuesday. I would suggest that in the meantime we remain perfectly quiet and keep these matters secret even from Oliver himself." Although Mr. Losbern received with many wry faces a proposal involving a delay of 5 whole days, he was fain to admit that no better course occurred to him just then. And as both Rose and Mrs. Maylie sided very strongly with Mr. Brownlow, that gentleman's proposition was carried unanimously. "I should like," he said, "to call in the aid of my friend Grimwig. He is a strange creature, but a shrewd one, and might prove of material assistance to us. I should say that he was bred a lawyer, and quitted the bar in disgust, because he had only one brief and a motion of course in 20 years, though whether that is a recommendation or not you must determine for yourselves. I have no objection to your calling in your friend, if I may call in mine," said the doctor. "We must put it to the vote,"
replied Mr. Brownlow. Who may he be? That lady's son, and this young lady's very old friend, said the doctor, motioning towards Mrs. Maley, and concluding with an expressive glance at her niece. Rose blushed deeply, but she did not make any audible objection to this motion. Possibly she felt in a hopeless minority, and Harry Maley and Mr. Grimwig were accordingly added to the committee.
We stay in town, of course, said Mrs. Maley, while there remains the slightest prospect of prosecuting this inquiry with a chance of success. I will spare neither trouble nor expense in behalf of the object in which we are all so deeply interested, and I am content to remain here if it be for 12 months, so long as you assure me that any hope remains.
Good, rejoined Mr. Brownlow. And, as I see on the faces about me, a disposition to inquire how it happened that I was not in the way to corroborate Oliver's tale, and had so suddenly left the kingdom, let me stipulate that I shall be asked no questions until such time as I may deem it expedient to forestall them by telling my own story. Believe me, I make this request with good reason, for I might otherwise excite hopes destined never to be realized, and only increase difficulties and disappointments already quite numerous enough. Come, supper has been announced, and young Oliver, who is all alone in the next room, will have begun to think by this time that we have wearied of his company, and entered into some dark conspiracy to thrust him forth upon the world. With these words, the old gentleman gave his hand to Mrs. Maley, and escorted her into the supper-room. Mr. Losberne followed, leading Rose, and the council was, for the present, effectually broken up. Chapter 42. An old acquaintance of Oliver's, exhibiting decided marks of genius, becomes a public character in the metropolis. Upon the night when Nancy, having lulled Mr. Sykes to sleep, hurried on her self-imposed mission to Rose Maley, there advanced towards London by the Great North Road two persons upon whom it is expedient that this history should bestow some attention. They were a man and woman, or perhaps they would be better described as a male and female, for the former was one of those long-limbed, knock-kneed, shambling, bony people to whom it is difficult to assign any precise age, looking as they do, when they are yet boys, like undergrown men, and when they are almost men, like overgrown boys. The woman was young, but of a robust and hardy make, as she need have been to bear the weight of the heavy bundle which was strapped to her back. Her companion was not encumbered with much luggage, as there merely dangled from a stick which he carried over his shoulder a small parcel wrapped in a common handkerchief, and apparently light enough. This circumstance, added to the length of his legs, which were of unusual extent, enabled him with much ease to keep some half-dozen paces in advance of his companion, to whom he occasionally turned with an impatient jerk of the head, as if reproaching her tardiness and urging her to greater exertion. Thus they had toiled along the dusty road, taking little heed of any object within sight, save when they stepped aside to allow a wider passage for the mail coaches, which were whirling out of town, until they passed through Highgate Archway, when the foremost traveller stopped and called impatiently to his companion.
"Come on, can't you? What a lazy bones you are, Charlotte."
"It's a heavy load, I can tell you," said the female, coming up, almost breathless with fatigue.
"Heavy? What are you talking about? What are you made for?"
rejoined the mail traveller, changing his own little bundle as he spoke to the other shoulder.
"Oh, there you are, resting again. Well, if he ain't enough to tire anybody's patience out, I don't know what is."
"Is it much farther?"
asked the woman, resting herself against a bank, and looking up with the perspiration streaming from her face.
"Much farther? You're as good as there,"
said the long-legged tramper, pointing out before him.
"Look there. Those are the lights of London."
"They're a good 2 miles off, at least,"
said the woman, despondingly.
"Never mind whether they're 2 mile off or 20,"
said Noah Claypole, for he it was.
"But get up and come on, or I'll kick you, and so I'll give you notice."
As Noah's red nose grew redder with anger, and as he crossed the road while speaking, as if fully prepared to put his threat into execution, the woman rose without any further remark, and trudged onward by his side.
"Where do you mean to stop for the night, Noah?"
she asked, after they'd walked a few hundred yards.
"How should I know?"
replied Noah, whose temper had been considerably impaired by walking.
near, I hope, said Charlotte.
No, not near, replied Mr. Claypole. There, not near, so don't think it.
Why not?
When I tell you that I don't mean to do a thing, that's enough without any why or because either, replied Mr. Claypole with dignity.
Well, you needn't be so cross, said his companion.
A pretty thing it would be, wouldn't it, to go and stop at the very first public house outside the town, so that Sowerberry, if he come up after us, might poke in his old nose and have us taken back in a cart with handcuffs on, said Mr. Claypole in a jeering tone.
No, I shall go and lose myself among the narrowest streets I can find, and not stop till we come to the very out-of-the-way house I can set eyes on. God, you may thank your stars I've got a head. But if we hadn't gone at first the wrong road a-purpose, and come back across country, you'd have been locked up hard and fast a week ago, my lady, and serve you right for being a fool.
I know I ain't as cunning as you are, replied Charlotte, but don't put all the blame on me, and say I should have been locked up. You would have been if I'd been anyway.
You took the money from the till, you know you did, said Mr. Claypole.
I took it for you, Noah, dear, rejoined Charlotte.
"Did I keep it?" asked Mr. Claypole.
"No, you trusted in me, and let me carry it like a deer, and so you are,"
said the lady, chucking him under the chin and drawing her arm through his. This was indeed the case, but as it was not Mr. Claypole's habit to repose a blind and foolish confidence in anybody, it should be observed, in justice to that gentleman, that he had trusted Charlotte to this extent, in order that, if they were pursued, the money might be found on her, which would leave him an opportunity of asserting his innocence of any theft, and would greatly facilitate his chances of escape. Of course, he entered at this juncture into no explanation of his motives, and they walked on very lovingly together. In pursuance of this cautious plan, Mr. Claypole went on without halting until he arrived at the Angel at Islington, where he wisely judged from the crowd of passengers and number of vehicles that London began in earnest. Just pausing to observe which appeared the most crowded streets, and consequently the most to be avoided, he crossed into St. John's Road, and was soon deep in the obscurity of the intricate and dirty ways which, lying between Gray's Inn Lane and Smithfield, render that part of the town one of the lowest and worst that improvement has left in the midst of London. Through these streets Noah Claypole walked, dragging Charlotte after him, now stepping into the kennel to embrace at a glance the whole external character of some small public house, now jogging on again, as some fancied appearance induced him to believe it too public for his purpose. At length he stopped in front of one more humble in appearance and more dirty than any he had yet seen, and having crossed over and surveyed it from the opposite pavement, graciously announced his intention of putting up there for the night.
"So give us the bundle," said Noah, unstrapping it from the woman's shoulders and slinging it over his own. "And don't you speak, except when you're spoke to. What's the name of the house? Three what?"
"Cripples," said Charlotte.
"Three cripples," repeated Noah. "And a very good sign, too. Now then, keep close at my heels and come along."
With these injunctions, he pushed the rattling door with his shoulder and entered the house, followed by his companion. There was nobody in the bar but a young Jew, who, with his two elbows on the counter, was reading a dirty newspaper. He stared very hard at Noah, and Noah stared very hard at him. If Noah had been attired in his charity boy's dress, there might have been some reason for the Jew opening his eyes so wide. But as he had discarded the coat and badge, and wore a short smock frock over his leathers, there seemed no particular reason for his appearance exciting so much attention in a public house.
"Is this the Three Cripples?" asked Noah.
"That is the Dabe of this house," replied the Jew.
"A gentleman we met on the road coming up from the country recommended us here," said Noah, nudging Charlotte,
perhaps to call her attention to this most ingenious device for attracting respect, and perhaps to warn her to betray no surprise.
"We want to sleep here tonight."
"I've not certa ducad," said Barney, who was the attendant sprite, "but I'll inquire."
"Show us the tap and give us a bit of cold meat and a drop of beer while you're inquiring, will you?" said Noah.
Barney complied by ushering them into a small back room and setting the required viands before them, having done which he informed the travellers that they could be lodged that night, and left the amiable couple to their refreshment. Now, this back room was immediately behind the bar and some steps lower, so that any person connected with the house, undrawing a small curtain which concealed a single pane of glass fixed in the wall of the last-named apartment, about 5 feet from its flooring, could not only look down upon any guests in the back room without any great hazard of being observed, the glass being in a dark angle of the wall, between which and a large upright beam the observer had to thrust himself, but could, by applying his ear to the partition, ascertain with tolerable distinctness their subject of conversation. The landlord of the house had not withdrawn his eye from this place of espial for 5 minutes, and Barney had only just returned from making the communication above related, when Fagin, in the course of his evening's business, came into the bar to inquire after some of his young pupils.
"Hush," said Barney. "Strangers in the next room."
"Strangers?" repeated the old man, in a whisper.
"Ah, and Robins, too," added Barney. "From the country. But something in your way, or I'm mistaken?"
Fagin appeared to receive this communication with great interest. Mounting a stool, he cautiously applied his eyes to the pane of glass, from which secret post he could see Mr. Claypole taking cold beef from the dish and porter from the pot, and administering homeopathic doses of both to Charlotte, who sat patiently by, eating and drinking at his pleasure.
"Aha!"
he whispered, looking round to Barney.
"I like that fellow's looks. He'd be of use to us. He knows how to train the girl already. Don't make as much noise as a mouse, my dear, and let me hear him talk. Let me hear him."
He again applied his eye to the glass, and turning his ear to the partition, listened attentively, with a subtle and eager look upon his face that might have appertained to some old goblin.
"So I mean to be a gentleman," said Mr. Claypole, kicking out his legs and continuing a conversation,
the commencement of which Fagin had arrived too late to hear.
"No more jolly old coffin, Charlotte, but a gentleman's life for me. And if you like, you shall be a lady." "I should like that well enough, dear," replied Charlotte. "But tills ain't to be emptied every day, and people get clear off after it." "Tills be blowed," said Mr. Claypole. "There's more things besides tills to be emptied."
"What do you mean?"
asked his companion.
"Pockets, women's ridicules, houses, mail coaches, banks," said Mr. Claypole, rising with the porter. "But you can't do all that, dear,"
said Charlotte.
"I shall look out to get into company with them as can," replied Noah. "They'll be able to make us useful some way or another. Why, you yourself are worth 50 women. I never see such a precious, sly and deceitful creature as you can be when I let you."
"Lor, how nice it is to hear you say so,"
exclaimed Charlotte, imprinting a kiss upon his ugly face.
"There, that'll do. Don't you be too affectionate, in case I'm cross with you," said Noah, disengaging himself with great gravity. "I should like to be the captain of some band, and have the whopping of 'em, and following 'em about unbeknown to themselves. That would suit me if there was good profit. And if we could only get in with some gentleman of this sort, I say it would be cheap at that £20 note you've got, especially as we don't very well know how to get rid of it ourselves."
After expressing this opinion, Mr. Claypole looked into the porter pot with an aspect of deep wisdom, and having well shaken its contents, nodded condescendingly to Charlotte, and took a draught, wherewith he appeared greatly refreshed. He was meditating another when the sudden opening of the door and the appearance of a stranger interrupted him. The stranger was Mr. Fagin, and very amiable he looked, and a very low bow he made as he advanced, and setting himself down at the nearest table, ordered something to drink of the grinning Barney.
"A pleasant night, sir, but cool for the time of year," said Fagin, rubbing his hands. "From the country, I see, sir."
"How do you see that?"
asked Noah Claypole.
"We have not so much dust as that in London,"
replied Fagin, pointing from Noah's shoes to those of his companion, and from them to the two bundles.
"You're a sharp fella," said Noah. "Only hear that, Charlotte."
"Why, one need be sharp in this town, my dear,"
replied the Jew, sinking his voice to a confidential whisper.
"And that's the truth.
Fagin followed up this remark by striking the side of his nose with his right forefinger, a gesture which Noah attempted to imitate, though not with complete success, in consequence of his own nose not being large enough for the purpose. However, Mr. Fagin seemed to interpret the endeavour as expressing a perfect coincidence with his opinion, and put about the liquor, which Barney reappeared with, in a very friendly manner.
"Good stuff, that,"
observed Mr. Claypole, smacking his lips.
"Dear," said Fagin, "a man need be always emptying a till, or a pocket, or a woman's reticule, or a house, or a mail coach, or a bank, if he drinks it regularly."
Mr. Claypole no sooner heard this extract from his own remarks than he fell back in his chair and looked from the Jew to Charlotte with a countenance of ashy paleness and excessive terror.
"Don't mind me, my dear,"
said Fagin, drawing his chair closer.
"Oh, it was lucky it was only me that heard you by chance. It was very lucky it was only me."
I didn't take it,"
stammered Noah, no longer stretching out his legs like an independent gentleman, but coiling them up as well as he could under his chair.
"It was all her doing. You've got it now, Charlotte, you know you have."
"No matter who's got it or who did it, my dear,"
replied Fagin, glancing nevertheless with a hawk's eye at the girl and the two bundles.
"I'm in that way myself, and I like you for it."
In what way?"
asked Mr. Claypole, a little recovering.
"In that way of business,"
rejoined Fagin.
"And so are the people of the house. You've hit the right nail upon the head, and are as safe here as you could be. There is not a safer place in all this town than is the Cripples. That is, when I like to make it so. And I've taken a fancy to you and the young woman, so I've said the word, and you may make your minds easy."
Noah Claypole's mind might have been at ease after this assurance, but his body certainly was not, for he shuffled and writhed about into various uncouth positions, eyeing his new friend meanwhile with mingled fear and suspicion.
"I'll tell you more,"
said Fagin, after he had reassured the girl by dint of friendly nods and muttered encouragements.
"I have got a friend that I think can gratify your darling wish, and put you in the right way, where you can take whatever department of the business you think will suit you best at first, and be taught all the others."
"You speak as if you were in earnest," replied Noah.
"What advantage would it be to me to be anything else?"
inquired Fagin, shrugging his shoulders.
"Here, let me have a word with you outside."
"There's no occasion to trouble ourselves to move,"
said Noah, getting his legs by gradual degrees abroad again.
"She'll take the luggage upstairs the while. Charlotte, see to them bundles."
This mandate, which had been delivered with great majesty, was obeyed without the slightest demur, and Charlotte made the best of her way off with the packages, while Noah held the door open and watched her out.
"She's kept tolerably well under, ain't she?"
he asked, as he resumed his seat, in the tone of a keeper who has tamed some wild animal.
"Quite perfect,"
rejoined Fagin, clapping him on the shoulder.
"You're a genius, my dear."
"Why, I suppose if I wasn't, I shouldn't be here,"
replied Noah.
"But I say, she'll be back if you lose time."
"Now, what do you think?"
said Fagin.
"If you was to like my friend, could you do better than join him?"
"Is he in a good way of business? That's where it is,"
responded Noah, winking one of his little eyes.
"The top of the tree employs a power of hands, has the very best society in the profession."
"Regular town maiders?"
asked Mr. Claypole.
"Not a countryman among them, and I don't think he'd take you even on my recommendation if he didn't run rather short of assistance just now,"
replied Fagin.
"Should I have to hand over?"
said Noah, slapping his breeches pocket.
"It couldn't possibly be done without,"
replied Fagin in a most decided manner.
£20, though. It's a lot of money."
"Not when it's in a note you can't get rid of,"
retorted Fagin.
"Number and date taken, I suppose. Payment stopped at the bank. Ah, it's not worth much to him. It'll have to go abroad, and he couldn't sell it for a great deal in the market."
"When could I see him?"
asked Noah, doubtfully.
"Tomorrow morning."
"Where?"
"Here."
"Said Noah. What's the wages?"
"Live like a gentleman,
board and lodging, pipes and spirits free, half of all you earn and half of all the young woman earns, replied Mr. Fagin.
Whether Noah Claypole, whose rapacity was none of the least comprehensive, would have acceded even to these glowing terms had he been a perfectly free agent is very doubtful. But as he recollected that in the event of his refusal, it was in the power of his new acquaintance to give him up to justice immediately, and more unlikely things had come to pass, he gradually relented and said he thought that would suit him.
But you see, observed Noah, as she will be able to do a good deal, I should like to take something very light.
A little fancy work? Suggested Fagin.
Ah, something of that sort, replied Noah. Then what do you think would suit me now? Something not too trying for the strength and not very dangerous, you know. That's the sort of thing.
I heard you talk of something in the spy way upon the others, my dear, said Fagin. My friend wants somebody who would do that well very much.
Why, I did mention that, and I shouldn't mind turning my hand to it sometimes, rejoined Mr. Claypole slowly, but it wouldn't pay by itself, you know.
That's true,
observed the Jew, ruminating or pretending to ruminate.
No, it might not.
What do you think, then?
Asked Noah, anxiously regarding him.
Something in the sneaking way, where it was pretty sure work, and not much more risk than being at home.
What do you think of the old ladies?
Asked Fagin.
There's a good deal of money made in snatching their bags and parcels and running round the corner.
Well, don't they holler out a good deal and scratch sometimes?
Asked Noah, shaking his head.
I don't think that would answer my purpose. Ain't there any other line open?
Stop, said Fagin, laying his hand on Noah's knee. The Kinchin lay.
What's that?
Demanded Mr. Claypole.
The Kinchins, my dear, said Fagin, is the young children that's sent on errands by their mothers with sixpences and shillings, and the lay is just to take their money away. They've always got it ready in their hands, then knock 'em into the kennel and walk off very slow, as if there were nothing else the matter but a child fallen down and hurt itself.
Roared Mr. Claypole, kicking up his legs in an ecstasy.
Lord, that's the very thing.
To be sure it is, replied Fagin. And you could have a few good beats chalked out in Camden Town and Battle Bridge and neighbourhoods like that, where they're always going errands, and you can upset as many kinchins as you want any hour in the day.
With this, Fagin poked Mr. Claypole in the side, and they joined in a burst of laughter, both long and loud.
Well, that's all right,
said Noah, when he had recovered himself and Charlotte had returned.
What time tomorrow shall we say?
Will 10 do?
Asked Fagin, adding, as Mr. Claypole nodded assent,
What name shall I tell my good friend?
Mr. Bolter,
replied Noah, who had prepared himself for such an emergency.
Mr. Morris Bolter. This is Mrs. Bolter.
Mrs. Bolter's humble servant,
said Fagin, bowing with grotesque politeness.
I hope I shall know her better very shortly.
Do you hear the gentleman, Charlotte?
Thundered Mr. Claypole.
Yes, Noah, dear,
replied Mrs. Bolter, extending her hand.
She calls me Noah as a sort of fond way of talking,
said Mr. Morris Bolter, late Claypole, turning to Fagin.
You understand?
Oh, yes, I understand. Perfectly,
replied Fagin, telling the truth for once.
Good night. Good night.
With many adieus and good wishes, Mr. Fagin went his way. Noah Claypole, bespeaking his good lady's attention, proceeded to enlighten her relative to the arrangement he had made, with all that haughtiness and air of superiority, becoming not only a member of the sterner sex, but a gentleman who appreciated the dignity of a special appointment on the Kinchin Lay in London and its vicinity. Chapter 43, wherein is shown how the artful Dodger got into trouble.
And so it was you that was your own friend, was it?
Asked Mr. Claypole, otherwise Bolter, when, by virtue of the compact entered into between them, he had removed next day to Fagin's house.
God, I thought as much last night. Every man's his own friend, my dear, replied Fagin with his most insinuating grin. He hasn't as good a one as himself anywhere.
Except sometimes, replied Morris Bolter, assuming the air of a man of the world.
Some people are nobody's enemies but their own, you know.
Don't believe that, said Fagin. When a man's his own enemy, it's only because he's too much his own friend, not because he's careful for everybody but himself. Pooh, pooh! There ain't such a thing in nature.
There oughtn't to be, if there is, replied Mr. Bolter.
That stands to reason. Some conjurers say that number 3 is the magic number, and some say number 7. It's neither, my friend, neither. It's number 1.
Ha-ha! Cried Mr. Bolter.
Number 1 forever! In a little community like ours, my dear,
said Fagin, who felt it necessary to qualify this position,
we have a general number 1. That is, you can't consider yourself as number 1 without considering me, too, as the same, and all the other young people.
Oh, the devil! Exclaimed Mr. Bolter.
You see, pursued Fagin, affecting to disregard this interruption,
we are so mixed up together and identified in our interests that it must be so. For instance, it's your object to take care of number 1, meaning yourself.
Certainly, replied Mr. Bolter. You're about right there.
Well, you can't take care of yourself, number 1, without taking care of me, number 1.
Number 2, you mean,
said Mr. Bolter, who was largely endowed with the quality of selfishness.
No, I don't, retorted Fagin. I'm of the same importance to you as you are to yourself.
I say, interrupted Mr. Bolter, you're a very nice man, and I'm very fond of you, but we ain't quite so thick together as all that comes to.
Only think, said Fagin, shrugging his shoulders and stretching out his hands. Only consider. You've done what's a very pretty thing, and what I love you for doing, but what at the same time would put the cravat about your throat that's so very easily tied and so very difficult to unloose? In plain English, the halter.
Mr. Bolter put his hand to his neckerchief as if he felt it inconveniently tight, and murmured an assent, qualified in tone but not in substance.
The gallows, continued Fagin. The gallows, my dear, is an ugly finger-post which points out a very short and sharp turning that has stopped many a bold fellow's career on the broad highway. To keep in the easy road and keep it at a distance is object number 1 with you.
Of course it is, replied Mr. Bolter. What do you talk about such things for?
Only to show you my meaning clearly,
said the Jew, raising his eyebrows.
To be able to do that, you depend upon me. To keep my little business all snug, I depend upon you. The first is your number 1, the second my number 1. The more you value your number 1, the more careful you must be of mine. So we come at last to what I told you at first, that a regard for number 1 holds us all together, and must do so, unless we would all go to pieces in company.
That's true,
rejoined Mr. Bolter, thoughtfully.
Oh, you're a cunning old codger!
Mr. Fagin saw, with delight, that this tribute to his powers was no mere compliment, but that he had really impressed his recruit with a sense of his wily genius, which it was most important that he should entertain in the outset of their acquaintance. To strengthen an impression so desirable and useful, he followed up the blow by acquainting him in some detail with the magnitude and extent of his operations, blending truth and fiction together as best served his purpose, and bringing both to bear with so much art that Mr. Bolter's respect visibly increased, and became tempered at the same time with a degree of wholesome fear, which it was highly desirable to awaken.
It's this mutual trust we have in each other that consoles me under heavy losses, said Fagin. My best hand was taken from me yesterday morning.
Well, you don't mean to say he died, cried Mr. Bolter.
No, replied Fagin. Not so bad as that. Not quite so bad.
What, I suppose he was wanted,
interposed Fagin.
Yes, he was wanted.
very particular?"
inquired Mr. Bolter.
"No," replied Fagin. "Not very. He was charged with attempting to pick a pocket, and they found a silver snuff-box on him. His own, my dear, his own, for he took snuff himself and was very fond of it. They remanded him till today, for they thought they knew the owner. Ah, he was worth 50 boxes, and I'd give the price of as many to have him back. You should have known the Dodger, my dear. You should have known the Dodger."
"Well, but I shall know him, I hope. Don't you think so?" said Mr. Bolter.
"I'm doubtful about it," replied Fagin with a sigh. "If they don't get any fresh evidence, it'll only be a summary conviction, and we shall have him back again after 6 weeks or so. But if they do, it's a case of lagging. They know what a clever lad he is. He'll be a lifer. They'll make the Artful nothing less than a lifer."
"What do you mean by lagging and a lifer?" demanded Mr. Bolter. "What's the good of talking in that way to me? Why don't you speak so as I can understand you?"
Fagin was about to translate these mysterious expressions into the vulgar tongue, and being interpreted, Mr. Bolter would have been informed that they represented that combination of words, transportation for life, when the dialogue was cut short by the entry of Master Bates, with his hands in his breeches pockets, and his face twisted into a look of semi-comical woe.
"It's all up, Fagin," said Charlie,
when he and his new companion had been made known to each other.
"What do you mean?"
"They've found the gentleman as owns the box. Two or three more's are coming to identify him, and the Artful's booked for a passage out," replied Master Bates. "I must have a full suit of mourning, Fagin, and a hatband to wizard him in afore he sets out upon his travels. To think of Jack Dawkins, Lummy Jack, the Dodger, the Artful Dodger, going abroad for a common chutney-hapney sneeze box. I never thought he'd have done it under a gold watch, chain and seals at the lowest. Oh, why didn't he rob some rich old gentleman of all his wallables and go out as a gentleman, and not like a common prig, without no honour nor glory?"
With this expression of feeling for his unfortunate friend, Master Bates sat himself on the nearest chair with an aspect of chagrin and despondency.
"What do you talk about his having neither honour nor glory for?" exclaimed Fagin, darting an angry look at his pupil. "Wasn't he always top sawyer among you all? Is the one of you that could touch him or come near him on any scent, eh?"
"Not one," replied Master Bates, in a voice rendered husky by regret. "Not one."
"Then what do you talk of?" replied Fagin angrily. "What are you blubbering for?"
"'Cause it isn't on the record, is it?" said Charlie, chafed into perfect defiance of his venerable friend by the current of his regrets.
"'Cause it can't come out in the 'dictment, 'cause nobody will never know half of what he was. How will he stand in the Newgate calendar? Perhaps not be there at all. Oh, my eye, what a blow it is!"
"Ha, ha!" cried Fagin, extending his right hand and turning to Mr. Bolter in a fit of chuckling which shook him as though he had the palsy.
"See what a pride they take in their profession, my dear. Ain't it beautiful?"
Mr. Bolter nodded assent, and Fagin, after contemplating the grief of Charlie Bates for some seconds with evident satisfaction, stepped up to that young gentleman and patted him on the shoulder.
"Never mind, Charlie," said Fagin soothingly. "It'll come out. It'll be sure to come out. They'll all know what a clever fellow he was. He'll show it himself and not disgrace his old pals and teachers. Think how young he is, too. What a distinction, Charlie, to be lagged at his time of life."
"Well, it is an honour, that is,"
said Charlie, a little consoled.
"He shall have all he wants," continued the Jew. "He shall be kept in the stone jug, Charlie, like a gentleman, like a gentleman, with his beer every day and money in his pocket to pitch and toss with if he can't spend it."
"No, shall he, though?" cried Charlie Bates.
"Aye, that he shall," replied Fagin. "And we'll have a big wig, Charlie, one that's got the greatest gift of the gab, to carry on his defence. And he shall make a speech for himself, too, if he likes, and we'll read it all in the papers. Artful Dodger, shrieks of laughter. Here the court was convulsed." "Eh, Charlie, eh?" "Ha, ha, ha!"
laughed Master Bates.
"What a lark that would be, wouldn't it, Fagin? I say, how the Artful would bother him, wouldn't he?"
"Would!" cried Fagin. "He shall! He will! "Ah, to be sure, so he will," repeated Charlie, rubbing his hands. "I think I see him now," cried the Jew, bending his eyes upon his pupil. "So do I," cried Charlie Bates. "So do I. I see it all afore me. Upon my soul, I do, Fagin. What a game! What a regular game! All the bigwigs trying to look solemn, and Jack Dawkins addressing of 'em as intimate and comfortable as if he was the judge's own son making a speech after dinner." In fact, Mr. Fagin had so well humoured his young friend's eccentric disposition that Master Bates, who had at first been disposed to consider the imprisoned Dodger rather in the light of a victim, now looked upon him as the chief actor in a scene of most uncommon